What face, Moxie thought, could such a voice belong to? "I've known young, sir," the hidden man said. "I've known so young that they do not yet exist." Moxie looked to the man's fat fingers upon the chair's armrests. The towels across his face appeared to tighten, and features emerged beneath them. The cheekbones rose, tenting the fabric as it valleyed smoothly into wide lips. And where there should be eyes, two bumps trained on Moxie's own. In the shadow by the neck of the slip, Moxie saw a worm-skin throat. Moxie removed his gun from its holster. "Why, I've known so young it's tragic. I've known young enough to be just a colonel. A guilt-addled thing floating at the surface of an old man's watery mind." The throat moved, slug-like, and Moxie believed, momentarily, that a great asp writhed beneath the towels. And the cloth grew tighter to the suggestion of a face. "If it's young you're looking for," the hidden man said, "I suggest the womb. It's the furthest young can be from old, and you can still see it, swimming in there, feeding off the blood of the mother. Dark hair, did you say? Yes, I may have seen her, strung up as she was in a tree. Her young blood dripping on the old earth, pooling like a mirror there, reflecting the bottom of her feet, the length of her legs, and up her filthy loose skirt." Moxie saw the fingers were thin and gray now, rice paper, flaking with the wind of Moxie's own question. "Who are you?" The towel was still, but the voice continued. "I'm a young girl hanging from a tree. I'm a goat starved with no master to feed it. My ribs poke the flesh of my flank. I'm the hollow of the trunk where the big spiders live and lay their eggs. I'm a thing old enough to know that old was once young, and that because young becomes old, there is no love of life, only a fear of decay. There is no favorite bow, nothing to keep it all from coming unwrapped. There are only bright flashes that hide the shape of me curled in the corner, reaching. I am a young girl's reflection in her own blood. I am one step beyond decay, sir. I am rot." Moxie spun from the figure, from the memory, too. But the thunder of his boots on the barbershop floorboards was interrupted by the thunder of the voice. "Go home, James Moxie. You passed on your chance to help her." Moxie whirled back and rushed the shape beneath the slip. He was upon it before the barbers could stop him. "Who are you?" Moxie tore the towels aside. A fat man with eyes bloodshot from sleep sat up in the seat, raging. "What in God's name are you doing, man?" A new voice, a different man. The other was gone. Rot. Moxie recalled a blurred evening in Portsooth. Advice to leave the woman he loved. As the fat man continued to shout, as the barbers rushed to pull Moxie aside, the possibility that the thing, rot, had been here, scared Moxie deep. Was he losing his mind, only a few hours upon the trail? Was he losing his mind? The details of Portsooth were filled in. A man whose face he could barely see, whose mouth seemed not to move as he spoke, whose dark expression seemed painted with grease paint for the stage. Moxie pulled himself from the hands of the barbers and stumbled toward the door. Through the glass, he saw Molly again. But Molly as she was now, dead 12 years.
"Molly!"
Moxie yelled. The girl's eyes, once green, were now a watery white. Her dark hair now flowed with ash. Moxie exploded out the door, reaching for Molly on the boardwalk, but his hands found nothing solid, no girl, dead or alive. As the door swung shut behind him, he heard the fat man carrying on.
"You should be ashamed of such behavior. I never heard of such a thing, accosting a man as he gets a shave. You ought to be put away. I was attacked. That man attacked me, did he not? It's an outrage, accosting a man as he gets a shave."
Moxie looked up and down the boardwalk, searching for the corpse of Molly. It struck him, insanely, that he'd take Molly as he'd seen her now, rotting, if it meant she'd repeat the past, the part she'd played in his life.
"You gotta meet my friend Carol."
If it meant she would deliver him to Carol. Seeing no girl, Moxie looked to the people of Baker for a false face, one so unnatural as to be grease paint upon the idiot smoothness of a mannequin. But no Rot, no Molly. Moxie hurried back to the mare, to the trail, to a funeral he needed to end before it began, to the woman he needed to save from being buried alive, no matter how many memories tried to stop him. Deep within, this idea comforted him. Despite the horrors he'd seen, the dark feelings he felt. For he had no doubt the memories were trying to stop him. Yet what need would there be to stop Moxie if Carol were already dead?
"Ride!"
Moxie called to the mare, and the mare rode. Despair in Howltown. She could hear him pacing before she heard him speak. Dress shoes on the gravel storeroom floor. Did he have a candle lit? That had always been the worst of it for her, the lack of light. Not in Howltown. Carol didn't expect any in there, but in the cellar itself. Just because she couldn't see didn't mean she didn't know the darkness of the unlit cellar. Black within black. As if the darkness below the house were pressurizing that of the coma, stuffing Carol deeper down. At first, she thought Dwight's scuffling was rats. Farrah claimed to have seen one as big as a badger, and it was difficult now to write that off as the hysterics of a young woman. Who knew what was down here when the lights were off, when the air was still, when no human posed a threat to their dwelling? But through the dark winds of her perpetual fall, Carol was able to determine they were shoes after all, for no animal moved with the neurotic regularity that this sound betrayed. A pendulum, it seemed, swinging beside her inert body on the slab. And yet Dwight's labored breathing was no match for the hoarse wheezing she heard inside the coma.
"You had to tell James Moxie. What'd you tell him for? Attention? Were you flirting? Did you want him to feel bad for you?"
His words pelleted the coma like globs of black tar. Angry rain in Howltown.
"How's heaven, Carol?"
Pacing, pacing. Breathing hard.
"He's on his way here. An outlaw. Hell's heaven, Carol. What can I do? What should I do?"
Even now, Dwight was asking for her help. Even in his plan to murder her, Carol had to do the dying first. Again, she felt the blue electricity through her nerves. Anger, terror, shock, and a leviathan sadness she hadn't imagined possible. Dwight had always argued that Carol went under following stressful events. Was it possible that now, given what she was forced to accept, this betrayal, that she would fall farther, deeper than she'd ever been before? How long would Carol stay under this time?
"No!"
She screamed the word without parting her lips, but the two letters were swallowed fast by the impenetrable darkness that propelled her. And yet, "no" was certainly better than "yes." Oh, to open her eyes right now.
"Right now!" "You say it takes 2 to 4 days,"
John Bowie once said.
"That means some falls are twice as long as others. That means you're not going to the same place every time. Does this mean something? Is there a finish line, a landing, after all?"
Carol couldn't help but imagine him as she'd last seen him, barefoot and unboxed at the bottom of a grave. Yet this dead version of John still sat in that wicker chair on the Evers' front porch, folded in on himself, running a coin along the knuckles of his hand as he thought of ways to help her.
"He's coming,"
Dwight said, and his voice was much closer now, the syllables grotesque.
"Will he kill me? Will he? Oh, Carol."
Closer yet, as if he was kneeling beside her. Carol heard tears in his voice.
"Please, don't let him kill me. Please don't, Carol."
She heard a flat, dull thud and hoped he'd hit the slab and not her defenseless body. Then Dwight started laughing, and the sound of it, in the coma, was the sound of a dying hyena, an animal left to starve.
"I've hired someone, Carol. Yes, I've hired someone to stop him from coming."
More of the blue electricity that she only felt but could not see. The flaming nerves that did nothing to illuminate the darkness she fell through. "Moxie is going to get killed," she thought. Then, as if she had to think it whether or not she wanted to. "For you." John Bowie spoke up again, his dead throat spouting philosophy still.
"I'm close,"
he'd once said, with a glass of whiskey in one hand, a playing card in the other.
There's a solution to this, and I'm close to figuring it out.
But he never did figure it out, not exactly, and Carol couldn't fault him. Even Hattie couldn't help.
What if I actually dropped you from a great height as you're falling, a safety net far below? Maybe the two falls would somehow cancel each other out.
So many wild theories. So many times Carol's mother and her best friend tried to help.
Help!
Carol tried to yell, but she knew that any help would have to come from within the coma. Any help would have to come from herself. As Dwight paced, he continued to speak, revealing everything. Carol understood that, if she were to wake, if she were to open her eyes right now, Dwight would have no choice but to kill her with his own hands. As his shoes kept anxious rhythm on the stormroom floor, Carol could hear Hattie at work, too. Her mother's perpetual tinkering. The time she built the back mattress so that Carol would never fall flat to the floor. The time she constructed the helmet out of birch. To the rain of her husband's selfish tears, Carol heard Hattie working. Then, as Dwight inhaled and exhaled the fear of an outlaw on his way, John spoke up, as he did the day he thought he figured it out. He'd sat up fast in the wicker chair and snapped his fingers.
Hey,
he said.
If you feel the wind against your face, it's obviously blowing up, and yet you're falling down.
There was a sparkle in his beautiful eyes that day, magnified by his glasses.
Might this mean you're not moving at all? Might you be sitting still? And if so, doesn't that sound more manageable? A falling woman is in a much worse predicament than one sitting still. Think about it, Carol. What can you do in there?
Carol remembered how they walked through the gardens and talked about that until the sun rose above Harrow's. She remembered, too, how they reached no conclusion, how John felt defeated for having, as he said,
come so close to figuring it out.
But now, as Dwight continued to pace, as deep blue volts continued to course through her blood and body, Carol thought maybe she and John had figured it out after all. What can a woman do who is stuck face down, neither falling nor rising, after all? Roll over, Carol thought. Then, incredibly, she laughed. Despite the horrors, the betrayal, the knowledge of a heinous husband and a former lover at a disadvantage, Moxie, not knowing he was being tracked, Carol found space enough to laugh. Roll over. Of all the words she and John Bowie exchanged, never had they mentioned these two. Her brief laughter was condors taking flight, vanishing into the folds of Howltown, where, Carol knew, they would find no food and starve. But as her laughter died, it was replaced with something much more useful to her. Hope. Rinaldo. Rinaldo was in Aberystown when Moxie performed the trick. In those days, he was sweeping peanut shells, broken glass, and a wide assortment of disgust from the floor of Lady Hennessy's bawdy house. He did other things, too, other duties, like cleaning the sheets. Just the thought of it now made him rush to the bucket, knocking on the doors when time was up, restocking the liquor shelves, and often dunking a whore's head in cold bathwater if Lady Hennessy thought her unable to perform. Dark days, yes, but Rinaldo now counted them as penance paid to bear witness to a miracle. James Moxie in Aberystown. A duel. Moxie the victor without removing his gun from its holster. As if the outlaw had sent a bullet his foe's way with his mind alone. Today, to his absolute astonishment, he had in his possession an official piece of paper with James Moxie's name on it. A piece of paper he should not have. Now nearing his 50th year, married with two lovely children, and living in a comfortable and clean home in Griggsville, Rinaldo kissed his wife on the forehead and went in to do the same to the little ones. The family took afternoon naps, and he often took this opportunity to muse alone in the big shed in the backyard. After tucking the sheets to his sons and daughters' little chins, he quietly closed the door behind him. Stepping outside, the afternoon air felt calming. He needed that. Calming. Summer sunlight washed the grass path and painted his boots a deep yellow. He came to the shed and whispered.
Who goes there?
Because today he was nervous. Today he'd been a part of something he didn't want to be a part of, shouldn't have been a part of, had no business with. Today he delivered his hero's death sentence. He entered the shed and stepped toward a pile of thick blankets stacked beside a brown wooden chest. On the chest was a small purple box, Rinaldo's own box of magic. After seeing James Moxie's feat in Aberystown, Rinaldo took quickly to the craft. He plopped onto the blankets and reached for a box of matches beside the box of tricks. The small shed and all its clutter showed when he lit one. Boxes of newspaper clippings, James Moxie wanted posters, and the tall wooden cabinet his wife, Liliana, refused to step inside of so that he might cut her in half. He reached his small hand under the blankets and removed a pipe. He leaned back into the blankets and smoked. The fabric seemed to soften beneath him, and soon he was sprawled, almost completely lying down. His mind swam with anecdotes, and sometimes he laughed, and other times he stared seriously at the ceiling. 30 minutes into this haphazard meditation, he bent forward and slipped his boots off, his feet naked upon the cold earth before he found them too cold and brought them up onto the blankets, where it was warmer. He sat this way for a long time, the candlelight dancing on the ceiling. A wolf or dog howled outside, and Rinaldo sat up fast, ripped from his splendor. The noise lent some urgency to the real reason he'd come to the shed. Removing the piece of paper from his pocket, Rinaldo held it where he could read it, and, squinting, read it again for the 7th time this day. James Moxie, stop. Macatoon, stop. On his way to Harrow's, stop. Send the cripple, stop. Urgent. He felt no less guilty about it for having smoked. His time at Lady Hennessy's, long ago, had exposed him to every variety of outlaw and trigger man that traveled the trail. For reasons he was unsure of, Rinaldo had become a confidant for these men, usually the bad ones. At the time, this gave him strange comfort, accepted as he was at all, even by men who leered, cheated, and murdered. Many nights he sat at the bawdy house bar, listening to the woes and wonders of real life on the trail. The men and women seemed to think he was safe. Perhaps it was his kind face. Perhaps it was the fact that he didn't speak much. For whatever the reason, Rinaldo was told things, too many things. Most outlaws, it seemed, experienced something like confession when talking to him. Soon, for this, his role in the bawdy house ballooned, a natural progression. His being a friendly ear became his being an ideal middleman, a nondescript nobody who could deliver their messages, telegrams, and, often, illegal notes. Many an evening at Lady Hennessy's ended with Rinaldo holding a piece of paper, similar to the one he held now, a word or two from the rapscallion who had written it, a message for someone equally beastly.
"See to it Johansson gets this. She'll be stopping in soon."
"Do me a favor, huh? And don't be showing this off."
"Hey, little Rinaldo, do me a favor.
Tell Lafayette I says hello."
For this, Rinaldo, too, became famous on the trail. But to his distress, not for the same reasons James Moxie had. Not famous for magic.
"Rinaldo in Aberystown, he's the one to go through." "Did you leave it with Rinaldo? Aberystown? Lady Hennessy's? You know the man."
Rinaldo, simple as he was, received these papers with the same expression he wore when he mopped. Much younger then, he thought little of the consequences of the words he delivered. He knew the men and women were bad, and could guess their correspondences were no better. Yet he had felt free from responsibility. After all, what was he doing but taking a sheet of paper from one hand and placing it in another? Lady Hennessy's had a way of pulling even the cleanest men into the mud. And Rinaldo, now very happy in Griggsville, called himself lucky for not having gotten dirtier, stuck there for longer than he was. Rinaldo reached for the pipe again. Today those questionable relations were renewed. "How did this happen?" he mused, flummoxed, smoke rising from his lips. The ceiling of the shed gave him no concrete response. Rinaldo had no doubt that what James Moxie did in Aberystown was real magic. Of course, by now he'd heard the same theories everyone had. Men loved to talk about it over cards, at the bar, waiting for a coach. Most tried to dissect the moment. Toothless drunks called it sleight of hand. Lawmen claimed another shooter. Young outlaws couldn't guess how to practice it. But hardly a man saw it happen like Rinaldo had. James Moxie faced Daniel Prouds over a ditch on Dunkel Street, and Prouds's chest exploded in deep rows before Moxie moved his hand. The blood bursting from Prouds's pink shirt would forever remain fixed in Rinaldo's memory. A sudden flight of red ravens, a rising cardinal corpse. Oh, how many times had Liliana listened to Rinaldo blabber, stoned, about Aberystown? His wife rolled her eyes at him so often, he was surprised they weren't loose. Smoking now, he remembered well the early years. When he and Liliana first moved to Griggsville, when he bought the disappearing box, and Liliana agreed to step inside. But, try as he might, he could not make her vanish until she explained it to him. Mirrors, she'd taught him. And so did Moxie use mirrors? Under a sun so bright? In front of a crowd of so many? Rinaldo learned many tricks in those days, trying hard to emulate the great James Moxie. And as the years passed, he accumulated many toys, many cards, the games and tricks that gave him infinite pleasure in the large shed, smoking from his pipe, often recreating Moxie's stance in Aberystown. Yes, there was a marginal flash, a gun fired, and yet, none drawn? Rinaldo pondered this once again. But the good cheer he usually felt was difficult to find.
Guilt,
Rinaldo said, watching the smoke dissolve into the candlelit ceiling. Because guilt was indeed what he was wrestling now. The ugly back-and-forth swinging of the heavy pendulum.
Guilt.
Today Rinaldo had delivered a message. Today he had taken a piece of paper to the post office and seen to it that the words he now saw by the shed's candlelight were sent far south, to Mackatoon, where James Moxie called home.
Moxie!
He suddenly screamed. How did this happen? Earlier, Rinaldo had been walking the streets of Griggsville when he saw the man named Mutton gesturing to him from across the road. Mutton, a snow-cold man whom Rinaldo never liked, even when he himself was in the loving throes of booze, gestured with a gloved hand and winked. Hell's heaven, Rinaldo thought. Already the old familiar sensation of his youthful tryst at the bawdy house returning. Don't go to him. But cross the road he did, unable to feign the ignorance he now so wished he had.
Thought you didn't recognize me there for a second, Rinaldo.
Mutton looked worse than Rinaldo remembered, the skin of his face like orange rinds.
Of course I recognized you,
Rinaldo responded, always wanting to be accepted. Always wanting to be liked. They exchanged false pleasantries before Mutton eyed Rinaldo a second longer than was comfortable, and said,
"Look here, Rinaldo. I'm in something of a bind. It seems I'm wanted yonder."
He fanned a gloved hand to a saloon door, where a heavy woman was looking their way.
"Yet I have some work to do."
Rinaldo felt suddenly as if he was at a place he shouldn't have come.
"You remember the old days, don't you, Rinaldo? You remember how it used to be."
Mutton pulled from his vest pocket a folded piece of paper. Rinaldo observed, but did not speak.
"What say you deliver this message for me? It's an easy gig, really. All you gotta do is step into the post office and send these 6 or 7 words. I'd very much appreciate it, seeing as I'm wanted yonder."
Rinaldo looked at the paper and thought of Liliana. He thought of the children.
"Of course," the bad man continued, "there's a coin or two in it for you."
Then he leaned forward, and Rinaldo smelled rat on the man's breath.
"Just like we used to do."
Rinaldo continued to stare at the paper, as if it were an invitation to his past, to a time before he met Liliana, to the days before love and family and his shed of magic.
"Now, you haven't changed, have you, Rinaldo?"
Rinaldo felt trapped by Mutton's gaze. And yet what harm could it do to do something he'd done so many times before? Aberystown was, after all, magic for Rinaldo. Reliving a sliver couldn't hurt. Too badly?
No, of course not. I'll deliver your telegram.
The people-pleaser. The yes-man. Still. Rinaldo took the paper. Mutton smiled, his gums black with smoke.
That a boy, Naldo. Just like we used to do.
After delivering the message, unable to shake a vision of Liliana wagging a finger at him and halfway home, Rinaldo stopped walking and decided to do something he'd never done before. He pulled the folded paper from his pocket and read the message he had delivered. Then he read it again. And again.
"Hell's heaven,"
Rinaldo said, and his voice sounded like it did 20 years ago as he naively fluffed pillows. The few words on the paper dug fast. Little knives, big wounds. His first inclination was to race back to the post office and tell them there had been a mistake. It was impossible these were the words he'd play a part in sending. James Moxie, stop. Macatoon, stop. On his way to Harrow's, stop. Send the cripple, stop. Urgent. There in the road, the sun felt uncomfortably hot. He sweat as though under the stage lights of a magic show of his own. One in which he had failed to fool anybody. Now in the shed, reclining in a cloud of smoke, Rinaldo leaned forward and stuck his short arms into the box of tricks on the chest at his bare feet. He removed a pack of cards and shuffled them, laying some out upon the dirt. He cried.
"Pick any card in the deck,"
Rinaldo said loud to the empty shed.
"Any card in the deck, and I'll show you which card you have chosen."
Then he removed a card and looked at it.
"Don't tell me what it is, though I must admit that it doesn't matter for this trick whether or not I know what it is."
The word trick made him ill, and Rinaldo looked about the shed, suddenly feeling cold, strange, and very alone.
"Now, slide it back into the deck, and I'll show you which it was."
But there was no thrill, no sleight of hand deft enough to conceal the ugliness he felt. The guilt. He slid the card back in the deck. He exhaled until he felt empty of air. Rinaldo, so long a stranger to guilt, set the cards back in the box and blew out the candle. He exited the shed, tiptoed quickly across the sunny yard, and entered his home by the back door. Passing his son and daughter's bedroom, he stopped, thinking he would slip inside and tell them hello. Perhaps their warmth would make him feel better. James Moxie, stop. Macatoon, stop. On his way to Harrow's, stop. Send the cripple, stop. Urgent. But in the hallways of his home, his hand upon the children's bedroom door, he thought he knew who the cripple was. He thought of a hatless man on stilts, tin legs, a limping cowboy, the cruelest man Rinaldo had ever encountered on the trail. Smoke. As if by opening the door, he would be exposing his children to this madman, Rinaldo went instead to the master bedroom, where Liliana still slept. He knelt beside the bed.
"I did something terrible today, Liliana."
He shook her. At first she did not stir, and Rinaldo saw that man again, as if he had already been here, to Rinaldo's very home, had already stolen the life from Liliana.
"Liliana!"
His wife shot up in bed, eyes wide.
"What? What is it, Rinaldo?" "I killed James Moxie."
Rinaldo couldn't see his wife well, but heard her grunt and knew she had rolled her eyes.
"You smoke too much, Rinaldo. You smoke too much."
Smoke gets a haircut. Holding the razor to the hatless man's neck, Quint couldn't quit thinking about his client's legs. There was something too fitting about it. Like all Quint had to do was move quick, and then the crazy-talking man, a trigger man possibly, would be symmetrical. No legs and no head. And if the man thought he was fooling anyone by covering them with his pants, he was surely mistaken. Quint had a peg leg of his own, but even he marveled at the fact that this man must have two.
"I heard word that the magic man was in town a bit earlier,"
Smoke suddenly said, pivoting from the subject he was on quickly. The heavyset barber hardly heard it happen. Quint's partner, the thinner Franklin, was busy washing hair in the back tub.
"And who would that be?"
Quint asked, setting the razor on the counter and picking up the scissors again. The limper had asked for only a little bit, and Quint wondered if that was because he had only a little bit of money. Hard to tell these days. Smoke smiled. In the glass, the smile looked genuine.
"An outlaw,"
Smoke said.
Hardy was in this very place of business.
Quint frowned, began cutting.
Just a little bit,
Smoke said. His eyes were fixed on Quint's in the glass.
I don't know of any magic man coming in here, he said. Then he called out to his partner. Franklin, you know of any magic outlaw who came in here earlier today?
Magic outlaw?
Franklin repeated. Smoke watched him in the glass, too. Saw the way he stroked his chin with one hand, thinking.
You mean James Moxie?
Smoke turned his head to face Franklin, and Quint cut off more than he'd meant to.
I'm sorry, mister.
But Smoke didn't care about the hair.
That's him, all right. Heard it on Nero Street a moment ago. Someone said James Moxie himself had been here in Baker, here in this shop.
Observing him in the glass, Quint felt suddenly uneasy at the sight of him. Surely this limper was a trigger man, and yet no guns.
Quint?
Franklin asked.
You think that was him?
Smoke's eyes traveled from one bald barber to the other. Quint considered.
I don't think so, Franklin. That man was in a huff.
A huff, you say?
Smoke asked.
What was he huffing about then?
Started shouting at a customer,
Franklin said.
Damn near scared the hog piss out of him.
How'd he do that?
Charged him, Quint said. Ran straight at him and tore the towels off his face.
But James Moxie,
Franklin said,
would he have to use his hands to do such a thing?
Smoke laughed.
I wouldn't laugh at a man like James Moxie, Quint said. Might be able to hear you still.
He's still here, you mean?
No, Quint said. Only he's able to do things us ordinary folk aren't.
Then the two barbers and the man getting a wash in the back began the inevitable exchange of myths.
Man has to use his hands.
Didn't in Averstown.
Stage show.
Magic.
Mind power, huh?
Something like it, yes.
Sure would hate to face him on Nero Street.
You've seen the fire in his eyes, enough to burn this place down.
Smoke, his hair only half cut, gripped the sides of the chair and pulled himself up to standing.
You know my name, too?
He said. Quint and Franklin exchanged glances across the shop. It had been a lively afternoon, indeed.
Well, I might, Quint said. But what I do know is that we're not quite finished here, if you'll sit back.
You know why they call me Smoke?
Quint tried not to look down to those legs again.
I don't know any smoke,
Franklin said. Smoke stared at Quint, saw the fear in his eyes, held it.
You do, though, don't you, heavy set?
Quint stepped back and nodded.
I've heard of a man named Smoke, yes. A bad man, indeed.
Smoke smiled. His hair, half done, made the look in his eyes even more unbalanced than when he'd walked in.
Did the magic outlaw say what made him so mad?
No, sir, he didn't.
Did he say anything at all?
Quint shook his head. Smoke took the razor from the counter.
Hey, now,
Franklin said. Smoke held out an open palm.
Let me tell you why they call me Smoke.
Then Smoke stepped toward the barber, razor neck high. Franklin and the customer in back sat still. Smoke brought the razor to Quint's neck.
It's because I got a trick of my own.
Okay, son.
I can vanish.
Okay. Watch it now.
Without?
Smoke suddenly turned the razor around, gave it handle first to the trembling barber.
Without paying for a haircut.
Then Smoke smiled. He limped past the heavy bald barber and stepped back out onto the Nero Street boardwalk. He looked up and down the road once, as if some evidence of the man he followed might remain. He saw potential information in the eyes of everyone who passed, and decided, finally, that when you were chasing someone, not stopping was always better than stopping. Moxie was no more magic than a mouse.
An old one,
Smoke said,
who will, sooner than later, need to stop.
Then Smoke limped across the uneven planks on his way to the castrated gelding, hitched to a sun-bleached post. Behind him, the barbers watched him through the glass of their front door. both held tight to the images of the crazed James Moxie and the Kurt Trigger Man, Smoke. Without talking about it, they both imagined the two of them vanishing farther up the trail where, eventually, their respective bedlams must meet. Moxie and Rinaldo. Griggsville wasn't easily seen from deeper south on the trail, but one had to pass through it to continue. The town was surrounded by pine and spruce-covered hills, a natural barrier, a great wooden barrel from which poured forth the sounds of human lust and vice, violence and ecstasy, fear, hatred, and joy. For those arriving after dark, whether from north or south, the lantern lights and great bonfires would give the town away, if the sound of the carousal hadn't already. But during the day, as Moxie rode now, it wasn't until the last breadth of hills that he could see the very height of Hogg's Hotel. Its fabled plaster snout pointed up to hell's heaven. The town gates, two tall wood posts wrapped tight with ivy, supported giant wire letters spelling Griggsville, and Moxie passed under, the shadow of the letters upon his face, then his back, then the back of the mare. There were more taverns in Griggsville than in any other town on the trail. It was a place to celebrate, a place to drink and to dance, a place to be young. But as wild as Griggsville was, most men did not remove their guns at cards. The house madams ran clean homes, and the streets were free of debris. Big shows were scheduled at the theaters. People from as far as Harrow's and Mackatoon came to experience the mammoth curtains dividing. The friendly lawman made sure it all ran well, and that the money the tourists brought in was not wasted. James Moxie looked the part that he was, a man passing through on a mare. No lawman stopped him upon entering, and he felt no eyes upon him. But he should have. A small man carrying lumber absently dropped a loose board when he saw the outlaw, and did not apologize to the lady who had to step over the wood on her way. James Moxie missed him, distracted by the town's good cheer, the sun high in the sky, the bright signs and polished steel hitching posts, the fabulous dresses the ladies wore, the hats, too, floating above the streets, seemingly independent of the heads they shadowed. He didn't see the wide-eyed man who now followed the mare, step for step, bumping into people on the boardwalk, knocking one man's papers to the planks. "Is it him?" Rinaldo thought. Is it possible he's here? It had been over a decade since he'd seen him, but a hero is always recognizable to those who adore him. Rinaldo saw the face from Aberystown hovering above the blood-red shirt Moxie wore. Moxie continued, slow for the traffic of bodies, multicolored coaches parked in front of the saloons and hotels, and other riders heading south, having already had their fun. The sounds of the townsfolk were soothing. The loneliness of the ride exposed therein, and Moxie allowed his mind to be carried by it, hidden inside, as the mare took his body through the revelry. He didn't hear it then, when the little man called to him from the dust rising from the hooves and boots in the road.
"James Moxie!"
The outlaw rode slowly through the gay streets. If anybody other than Rinaldo cared to study them, Moxie and the mare might look out of place after all. A tiny one-man cortege, gray and dusty brown, the farthest point of an unseen procession.
"James Moxie!"
Now Moxie did hear the excited voice, but did not address the man who it belonged to. Griggsville was too easy a place to get stuck in.
"Mr. Moxie! James Moxie!"
The outlaw felt tugging at his boot, and he looked down, his eyes blazing. Rinaldo removed his hand fast. The awe he felt was paralyzing, but he found motion with his mouth.
"My name is Rinaldo. I need to speak with you. It is very urgent we speak."
"I'm only passing through," Moxie said, and his voice was saloon doors creaking closed.
"You must. We must speak for a moment. I have news for you."
Moxie kept his eyes on the road ahead.
"It's about you."
Rinaldo thought of Liliana, shooing him and his fancies away.
"It's about you and the men who are after you."
"No men are after me."
"Yes, yes, they are. I delivered the telegram myself."
Moxie, his idol, looked down at him again and stopped the mare. The Griggsville bustle went on. People passed, voices tangled in bliss.
"Tell me more, Rinaldo."
Rinaldo breathed heavily. James Moxie had just spoken his name.
"Please,
Rinaldo said, his lungs burning.
Let's not talk in the middle of the road.
I've no time to waste.
I won't waste your time.
Moxie, feeling the dirt road and flow of traffic continuing now without him, feeling the pinch of time lost, the clock that ticked beside a sleeping Carol, followed Rinaldo to the side of the road.
I didn't realize the message I was delivering,
Rinaldo said, speaking fast, wiping his forehead dry with a handkerchief from his pocket.
A bad man gave it to me.
An old couple stepped to the side, avoiding the pair. Moxie, still upon his horse, asked, What did the telegram say? Rinaldo swallowed.
It said, You are in Macatoon, on your way to Harrow's, I believe. It said to send the cripple.
Moxie looked back to the road, his eyes distant, considering. Animated, Rinaldo continued.
The man who gave me the telegram, he was no good, James Moxie. You must believe me.
The street felt too crowded for Moxie then, the sun too hot. Hotter than when he passed under the great wire letters. And within this sudden disorientation, Moxie understood that what the little man was telling him had much bigger implications than he knew. If someone was tracking him, someone had hired the man to do so. Who? Who gave you this telegram, Rinaldo?
A man named Mutton.
Where did it come from? What town? Harrow's? The Griggsville heat came down hard. Sweat fell from the outlaw's face. The brim of Moxie's hat blocked the sun above, and in his silhouette, Rinaldo saw two burning white eyes, teeth clenched. He felt he must answer this question. But he couldn't. He didn't know where the telegram came from.
I'm sorry.
Moxie was long quiet, then said, Thank you for your help, Rinaldo. Rinaldo, relieved, slapped the mare on her side.
You are welcome, James Moxie, man of magic.
Moxie, lost in the future, the past, and the present too, responded quietly. There was no magic, Rinaldo. Rinaldo did not hesitate to respond.
Oh, that isn't true. I saw it. I was there.
There was no magic.
I wish you could stay. You could take lodging with my family and me. You could show me how the trick was done.
I thank you again, Rinaldo. Then he kicked the mare and guided her back into traffic. Rinaldo, overwhelmed, watched him go.
Be safe, Moxie!
Then, as Moxie fell from view, as he was too far for Rinaldo to reach, Rinaldo felt a sudden pang of terror.
Oh, no! I didn't tell him that the trigger man's name is Smoke!
He imagined Liliana again, wagging a finger. Maybe Moxie knew Smoke, could spot him if he knew who was coming. Moxie, nearing the north side of town, imagined Carol plucking finite breaths from a glass jar at her bedside. He felt he had wasted time indeed. Whoever was following him had surely gained. And the rush to Harrow's was heightened, the guilt for Carol increased. Send the cripple. Moxie studied Rinaldo's words. As the rage within him swelled, the guilt grew too. And the sun began to go down on Griggsville. Manders prepares a grave. The office at the funeral home was closed, it being close to dark, but Robert Manders would have answered the door had anyone knocked. The illness that had come to Harrow's, an illness that Dr. Walker believed was either contained or gone, brought the home much work to do, and Manders couldn't rule out the possibility of more coming. It was a delicate business, being the director of a vibrant town's one death depot, and Manders never forgot the cardinal rule of his profession. No matter how many bodies came through his front doors, each was the only for those who carried it. His father took over the home when Robert was 10 years old. Until then, Dad was a gravedigger, a job that stained his clothes with grass and earth, and gave him a distinct odor, a cloud of something not quite antique, but not fresh either. A smell young Robert detected in the house before seeing the old man was home. Dad worked with a digger named Hubert, and the pair discussed much over the empty plots they dug. A favorite topic was the idea of one day owning their own funeral home, hiring grave diggers instead. The sudden death of Howard Loren, the home's owner at the time, made this a surprising possibility. After a brief meeting with town officials, the two young grave diggers got permission to purchase the place on loan and begin to run it themselves. Who else was so eager to handle the dead, so ready?
Robert and his mother moved into the home with Dad, taking residency on the second floor. And thus began the young Manders' long desensitization to death, dead bodies, and the crude process of preservation. By the time he was 15, he could do the work himself. And by the time Robert was 20, Hubert sold Alan Manders his share of the place, and suddenly Robert was next in line, his future secured.
Robert?
Manders had been looking out the window, dazed, mechanically watching the men dig a fresh plot. The name Alexander Wolfe played and replayed in his head. Dwight Evers's doctor of choice. Manders was leaning back in his chair, his fingers to his chin, half-storing the image of the silhouettes against the darkening sky. He turned slowly to the door.
Yes, Norman, come in.
Norman was wearing his white apron and smelled of the stuffy basement.
I'm finished.
Robert nodded.
Very well. How did it go?
It's good work.
Robert smiled.
I'm sure it is.
When the diggers arrived this afternoon, Manders talked to them about Carol Evers. He discovered the pair had already learned of her death. He walked them to the plot listings on the wood square outside the cemetery gates. There he explained where she was to be buried. The men had other graves to dig, but they assured the director they would get to Carol's before the sun went down. Manders turned to leave when Lucas said,
Plot 20 will be an improvement on where she rests now.
Often the talk between the gravediggers was nonsense to the director, but this bit caught Manders' attention.
What was that, Lucas?
I said,
And where does she rest now?
In the cellar of the Evers' home, Mr. Manders. Heard it from the husband of Mrs. Ferradero. Girl saw Carol Evers there herself yestereve.
Behind his glasses, Manders's eyes grew distant. Then he reminded the men they had much work to do, excused himself, and crossed the gravel drive to the front stone steps of the home. Much of the rest of his day was spent looking absently out the window. At one point he left the office and took the stone stairs to the basement, where Norman was preparing the body of Wilhelm Boyd, the 77-year-old former attorney. Though it was Manders' job to ensure things were done right, the director had given the deceased only a cursory glance. Norman was truly the best at what he did. In his lifetime at the home, Robert had never known a man who performed his part more fastidiously.
How are we on supplies?
Manders asked, then in the basement. But his voice was distant, his mind someplace else.
Eh?
Manders didn't repeat himself, and Norman didn't ask him to. The director circled the table supporting Wilhelm Boyd's body and sat upon a stool at the far wall. Norman worked as if no one was there, and in a way no one was. Manders watched but did not register the steadfast makeup artist. Instead, he took in the vague shades of movement, the process he had borne witness to 1,000 times, and did not fight to keep his mind from wandering. Now, both in the office, Norman was through.
I'll be going home now, Mr. Manders.
The director nodded. As Norman removed his apron, Manders said,
Carol Evers won't be coming here.
The body dresser bunched his thick brow. Often, under the basement lights, Norman's face looked theatrical, leathery, and hard. Now it looked downright vaudevillian.
How's that?
Seems Mr. Evers has hired family to take care of it.
Norman seemed to consider this, then said,
I'll be going home, Mr. Manders. Mr. Boyd is ready.
Very well, and thank you. Good evening to you.
Norman left, and Manders resumed his long stare out the office window.
Plot 20 will be an improvement on where she rests now.
Through the glass, he saw the diggers were shin-deep and the sky much darker beyond them. Manders rose and exited the office, then the home itself. Crossing the yard, passing the podium of plot locations, he came to the diggers.
I told you, too, it was going to be a Benson?
His voice carried across the quiet graveyard.
Yes, you did, sir. This'll work for a Benson.
Oh,
Manders said.
I'm sure it will. I just wanted to make sure you knew.
Hugh Benson was a carpenter in town. As coffin makers went, he was not Manders' preferred craftsman.
We're going to have to make sure the bearers hold tight, sir.
Manders nodded.
Yes, we are, Lucas. It wouldn't be the first time a Benson split on us.
If you asked Robert Manders, Hugh Benson's coffins weren't much more than 6 pieces of wood and a few picture-framing nails. In fact, he wondered if Benson didn't cut his wood with a dinner knife. Certainly not the right box for a woman like Carol Evers.
You expecting a big showing, sir?
No. A private ceremony. Perhaps Mr. Evers alone. Lucas looked at Manders.
I'd have thought the whole town would be out for this one. Mrs. Evers was liked by all, I reckon.
Indeed she was, Manders said. Manders watched the men work for a minute or more. Lucas's boots and shins vanished in the shadows of the hole with the shovel head. Manders looked to John Bowie's grave. Still looked fresh. Not quite one with the rest of the graveyard. And here one of Bowie's best friends would be joining him already.
I have some matters to attend to, gentlemen.
It was true, but back in his office, he didn't acknowledge them. He sat in the dark instead, the last vestige of sunlight creeping beyond a horizon wide enough to distort it, sending a purple wash through the window and across his desk. He tapped his fingers upon the chair's armrest and made to get up, but stayed put. He leaned back in his chair again, and then leaned forward and sighed and tapped his fingers on the desk instead. From a drawer, he removed a sheet of paper, and in the waning light made notes he didn't need to make. Things he would do without a reminder. See Marcy Donaldson about flowers. Talk to August Marbles. What will the weather be like? Make sure Lucas reinforces the coffin. Get Belle from town. He glanced out the window. The gravediggers weren't visible now. All Manders could see were the tallest of the headstones, spiking above the tangle of crosses and stones. But the director didn't need to see the men to know their actions in detail. By memory and imagination, he watched them patting the sides of the deep hole with their shovel heads, checking the height against their own. Manders rose from his chair at last and crossed the office. His boots clucked against the wood floor, then got quiet as he stepped on the rug before the bookshelf. He lit a candle and took the stick from the lower shelf, lifting it up and up until it was just above his head. With his other hand, he reached and pulled down a heavy leather volume and returned with it to his desk. Harrows and surrounding areas, ledger of registry. The black letters went deep into the thick auburn leather. Manders adjusted his glasses and opened it. He was still reading, the candlelight dancing about the office, when the gravediggers finished and went home for the night. He was alone now, both in the parlor and on the grounds, and he was still reading when the purple wash of sky gave way to gray, then a deep blue marking another night's arrival. And where did she rest now? In the cellar of the Evers home, Mr. Manders. Girl saw her there herself. Manders flipped the pages. The fine paper sounded hollow, like it wasn't strong enough to deliver him what he desired. But still he flipped and flipped, leaning closer and closer to the text, the words, the names. The name Alexander Wolfe continued to sound off in his head, and Manders searched for him, searching for Dwight Evers' doctor of choice. Was it possible Robert Manders hadn't heard of a doctor who lived near? His fingers passed over the thin white pages, looking, searching, hoping. Dwight prepares for bed. Dwight hung his suit coat on the chair at the vanity. He caught his reflection, thought he looked reasonably grieved, but still messed up his hair in the glass. There was no one to perform for in this room, but Dwight wanted desperately to stay in character, as if the wallpaper might tattle. His tie hung loose around his neck, and his boots were already at the foot of the bed. Unbuttoning his white shirt as he walked, he hung it and the tie on the hook inside the boudoir door. At the sink in the washroom, he washed his face and cleaned his teeth and ran his wet hands over his lips. The morning after tomorrow, he thought, Carol will be buried. The thought was not comforting. The date was not soon enough. What if she were to wake before then? What if she were to wake right now? James Moxey hadn't left his mind since the moment Dwight read that he was coming. Lafayette had told him not to worry. The freak smoke would do the job. But there would be hell's heaven to pay if he didn't. Moxey would talk about Carol's condition. Moxey would tell Sheriff Opal.
Opal would tell Manders. Together they'd exhume Carol, check, find scratch marks inside the coffin, ask Dwight why he hadn't mentioned her condition. Surely he knew of it. Didn't he think it might apply? Stepping to the bed, Dwight held an image of the two men, the outlaw and the trigger man, lost somewhere in the darkness of the trail. Where was Smoke now? Where was Moxie? For all Dwight knew, the cripple was drinking his own blood on a riverbed, possibly face down in pig shit, full of holes. Maybe James Moxie was plunging a knife in Smoke's back this minute as he, Dwight, sat on the edge of his large, hard mattress. It was foolishness, placing a thing of such importance in the hands of a risky stranger. "You're trafficking in madmen now," Lafayette had said in their meeting. Dwight's hands shook with the memory. He pulled off his socks and tossed them onto the bearskin rug. It was possible that Moxie was holding the cripple's head underwater now, an old rusty tub in some woeful hotel washroom. It wasn't difficult for Dwight to imagine water splashing over the sides of that tub, the name of he who'd sent him, already out of the trigger man's mouth and into the mind of the outlaw. "Who would then come for you, Dwight, old boy?" Another flat reality of Lafayette's, and Dwight knew the sow wasn't exaggerating. But did Smoke know who'd hired him? Had Dwight overlooked that aspect? Should he have told Lafayette to leave his, Dwight's, name out of it? And more important right now, could a crippled man defeat a legend like Moxie? The chaos frightened him deeply. Dwight was out of his element, way out. 95% of the couple's money came from Carol and her family. The house, the company, the clothes, all were either bought by or initially funded by Carol's side over the course of their 17-year marriage. That Hattie, always lurking, always present, long after her own death. Not only had Dwight never hired a man to murder before, he hadn't paid for laundry in almost 2 decades. Where was Smoke now, right now? Lafayette had assured him there was no question the cripple had enough time to get to the outlaw. Yet these things had a way of happening, former lovers coming together, old love, people connected by the dust traces of a past bond, something to do with fate, or the way things were, and the way they still are. Anxious, he got up off the bed and removed his pants. He blew out the candle on the small table where Carol used to set her handbag, her hat, her mirrors. The bedroom was now lit by a single candle on the other side of the bed, his side, and early moonlight slipped in through the open drapes. He crossed the room and peered outside, through the glass, to the front yard below. Was Moxie out there, crouched in the shadows beneath the sill? Dwight inched back from the glass. Maybe there was a gun pointed at him. A gun in the hand of a legend whose name struck fear into the hearts of heartless men and women like Lafayette. Dwight could feel it. The cold tunnel a bullet might pass before shattering the glass, shattering the bones of his ribs, splintering his bones against the green stone wall above the bed. He could smell it, he thought, the smoke rising from a gun that was always hot, a gun that was boiling the moment it was drawn. He could hear it, too, a click out there, the swoosh of the steel against the leather holster, the horse hoof clacking, and the explosion of a pure shot, all just before his skull cracked, a dropped soup bowl, his bones held twig-like together by baggy skin. Dwight physically shuddered. Where was James Moxie? Right now. Dwight got into bed, leaned across the mattress, and blew out the remaining candle. The bedroom went dark, and he stared into the blackness beyond his feet. The moonlight did not reach that darkness. But it did touch some of the furniture along the window's wall, distorting it, changing the chair into a crouched, crippled man, the high boy into a legendary outlaw without remorse. "He walked out on her 20 years ago. Dwight spoke into the darkness. "Why would he come back now?" The unfairness of it squeezed him. A vision again of Smoke, his head in a trough, Moxie above him, soot-faced, howling. "Who sent you? Who sent you?" But did Smoke know? Dwight's lack of knowledge of the ways of the trail scared him deeply. Soon the night birds called beyond the window glass. The frogs and grasshoppers followed. Dwight lay on his back, his hair soft upon the pillow. He pulled the blanket up to his chest and closed his eyes.
Moxie's telegram appeared like blood-red letters typed into the ceiling. Do not bury. Not dead. On my way. The unseen threads of former lovers. Dwight stared long enough for his eyes to get used to the dark. Long enough to feel confident that the shape in the corner was Carol's vanity. The shape beside that, the door. Breathing heavy, he fell asleep. Images of the crippled madman roving a featureless landscape outside all time and detail. And the outlaw, too. As Dwight dreamed, James